I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Trevor Corson has been interested in lobsters ever since he was a boy when he spent his summers on the coast of Maine. However, as a journalist, his focus was on Asia and not Asian food either. It wasn't until he wrote an article for the Atlantic Monthly that he began to think much about lobsters again, and then that article grew into a book, The Secret Life of Lobsters, How Fishermen and Scientists Are Unraveling the Mysteries of Our Favorite Crustacean. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm pleased that it and those mysterious crustaceans have brought him to my show today. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've written about topics as diverse as electric cars and Chinese politics. Did the Atlantic Monthly ask you to write about lobsters? How did they know you were even interested?
There was an interlude there in my life that didn't come up in the intro, which is that at some point in Asia, I got really homesick. And I remembered those childhood summers on the coast of Maine, and I wanted to do something different. I needed a new writing project. I thought, well, why don't I go live on a little island that has 70 people on it for 2 years and work on a fishing boat and see what happens.
And you became a stern man?
I was a stern man.
What is a stern man?
Well, most of my friends thought I was completely insane to take this job because it involves getting up at 4:30 in the morning, going out on the rough seas pretty much from all summer long in through the winter as well, through January, and stuffing bag after bag full of stinky fish. You're up to your elbows in this nasty fermenting mackerel and herring into little bags, processing trap after trap that comes up with lobsters. And it was not the career that my friends or parents had had in mind for me.
Well, especially since you were an award-winning journalist. You had been the managing editor of Transition, which won 3 awards for international reporting during your time there. Most people would see this as a backward step, at least,
right.
a poor career move.
Yeah, right.
Were you thinking about politics at all when you were up there at 4:30 in the morning?
Well, it was interesting because I began to realize that there were a lot of politics involved in the lobster fishery. One of the first things I noticed was that the fishermen were very keen observers of the lobsters, of the resource they fished. And I also realized after a while that they had some serious disagreements with the government folks who were charged with managing the lobster resource. So I didn't know what the story would be when I started working on a boat. I just thought there must be a story there somehow. And eventually I began to catch on to some of the things that were going on.
So you're suggesting that lobster fishermen actually are very conservation conscious, but they just don't follow the same rules that government might make or that scientists might have in the past?
Yeah, it's been very interesting over the years to see what's happened. The lobster fishery in Maine actually almost went completely bust in the 1920s. It was a terrible time for fishermen. And in the second half of the 20th century, I think a new generation of lobstermen seemed to have realized that they couldn't just fish out all the lobsters. And, of course, that is what has happened in many other New England fisheries. The cod fishery is almost completely bankrupt. And the lobster is the only story where the fishery has done well. And part of that may be because lobstermen in Maine started doing some strange things. One of them was when they pulled up a lobster that had eggs on the tail. You can see the eggs on the underside of a female lobster's tail. They would cut a little notch in her tail flipper and throw her back. And then every time that lobster came up again, whether it had those eggs or not, it had to be thrown back. So that's an example of one of the things that fishermen were doing.
And that notch told the lobster fisherman that this was an egg-bearing female.
It was a proven breeder, right, mm-hmm. And that a certain percentage of those would come up in the traps, and that way they'd have a certain percentage of females that were out there protected making eggs. Now, government scientists thought this was crazy. This is, you know, a sort of folk wisdom idea that has no basis in science, and it's ludicrous. And so for many years, scientists and fishermen fought over this and other conservation techniques. So that was one part of the story.
Well, also, you mentioned that cod had been pretty much fished out, and cod were predators.
Right.
Lobsters actually were among their favorite dishes, and if the cod disappeared, then the lobster had a lot easier, didn't they?
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing because we think of lobsters as these armored, you know, armored weaponed creatures who would be impervious to attack. But in fact, just as that lobster's tail makes a great meal for us, it also made a great meal for a large fish, for instance, a codfish. And the Gulf of Maine used to be swarming with large codfish.
Did it change the taste of the codfish?
You mean if it ate a lot of lobster, yeah. You might have had a kind of, yeah, a sort of a seafood mix there. I don't know.
Advertised lobster-fed cod.
Right. But you're exactly right. What happened was that as the cod got fished out, the lobsters had fewer predators. We don't know if there's a very strict connection there. There's no evidence that the lobster boom, and there has been a lobster boom in Maine in the past 15 years, has resulted because of the lack of codfish, but there may be a connection.
Now, Europeans, especially the French, will tell you that their lobster tastes better than American lobsters. Is there a real difference?
The two lobsters are very similar. Most people don't know what a European lobster looks like. It looks exactly like one of ours, but it's a bluish-black color instead of our kind of greenish-brown color. And otherwise, the species are so closely related that they can actually mate with each other, although the offspring aren't viable. As for taste, I sampled a European lobster a few years ago, and I thought it was okay. But there's a great variety in our lobsters, too, to be fair.
It all depends, I guess, on what you're brought up on. But the mating is an interesting issue because until fairly recently, scientists didn't know much about lobsters, including their mating habits.
Yeah, the story that I traced through the book is this series of incredible discoveries about lobster behavior and biology and ecology, and alongside that is the story of the fishermen who've started to participate a bit in the research. And yeah, I learned a lot of amazing things in the course of researching this book, but probably the mating habits of lobsters was really the most impressive.
And the fact that they're very social creatures. They have highly structured encounters with each other.
Right. We think of them as being very solitary, you know, hiding under a rock.
I think of them in a tank, usually moving very slowly as the bubbles go
right,
up to the
right,
surface.
Right, right, right. In fact, in the wild, they live in sort of structured neighborhoods, and they're very social. Now, that's not to say that they like each other. They're very social in the sense that they hate each other very much, very actively.
So they recognize each other?
It turns out, and this was an amazing series of experiments done to find this out, but lobsters are capable of recognizing each other because when two lobsters fight to decide which lobster is going to be the dominant, the lobster that loses will back down every time he meets that lobster for the next week. And it turns out his memory lasts only about 7 days, and then they have to fight again to decide who's the
better. That's better than me sometimes.
For short-term memory.
So how do they mate with those terrible shells that they have?
I
would think it would make it difficult.
Exactly. The problem is these lobsters are very belligerent, and getting them in the mood for love is tough.
The females are as belligerent as the males?
The females are pretty belligerent, too. And what happens is the male lobster in a particular neighborhood who establishes himself as the dominant alpha male, he goes around, beats up all the other lobsters every night, including the females. And they find this very arousing. So they go start to check him out, visit his shelter, but they have to drug him into submission because he's only interested in fighting. So they release pheromones, drug him into submission, and then this is the amazing thing, the females, one after another, they move in with him, mate, move out, and then the next one moves in, mates, moves out. I'm sorry, gentlemen in the audience, but the other male lobsters don't get any lady callers at all.
So it's only, this is the equivalent of the dominant male in, let's say, an ape group.
Yeah, although it's not quite a harem situation. He takes consecutive turns with each female, and they have a nice little bond for about 2 weeks. It's called serial monogamy.
It also turns out that lobsters are right-clawed or left-clawed.
Yeah, the crusher claw is the big, thick, muscular claw, and the thinner one is called the cutter claw. And what happens is that the young lobster begins to favor one of those claws over the other for certain tasks, whether it's crushing open a clam or cutting a piece of fish. And that causes one of those claws to become the crusher, one to be the cutter, and it's fairly random. So you get right-handed lobsters and left-handed lobsters.
Now, all sorts of conservation methods have been imposed over the years. Have most of them been misguided?
Well,
I mean, the state of Maine started in the 19th century, didn't it?
Right. Their first conservation rules were in the late 1800s. And then, as I described, there was this bust in the fishery in the 20s and 30s. So after World War II, lobstermen went back to protecting the young lobsters, the small ones, the oversized lobsters. They protect the big ones because they believe that leaves some big lobsters out there to mate and make lots of eggs. And they did this V-notching thing that I talked about. And since then, there have been efforts to increase the minimum size of lobster to protect it. Lobstermen for a long time thought those efforts weren't necessary. So there's been a big fight over the past several decades over this. And part of the story I tell in the book is how a new group of scientists has emerged that has begun to think that some of the things the lobstermen are saying are actually right, that the lobstermen have been doing a pretty good job.
Although smaller lobsters aren't always better, are they? Don't they make more money from the bigger ones? That means leaving them for a longer time?
The way the fishery works, and this was the experience I had on the boat, we were busiest in the fall because the fall harvest is when you're catching all the lobsters that have just shed their shell during the summer to grow up to be bigger lobsters. And they've just shed up and now meet that minimum legal size. So you're catching the large proportion of the catch is those lobsters that have just molted up. So most of the catch in Maine is those smaller lobsters.
So the life of a lobster from spring to fall corresponds with how successful the fishing is. Is there a better understanding of why the lobster catch fluctuates from year to year?
That's the key mystery in the book that I address. And in the sense that the book reads a little bit like a detective novel, that's what we're trying to figure out. And we do know some things now that we didn't know quite recently, and it's fascinating. It appears that the environment itself may be affecting the fluctuation in the population in the sense that lobsters hatch their eggs. The eggs then float up to the surface, float around as larvae for a couple of weeks, and land somewhere. And there's a very complicated series of connections that have to be made for the larvae to be carried by ocean currents to the right place so they can grow up in a nursery ground. There are certain places along the coast that seem to be nursery grounds for baby lobsters. So all of these things are in play and may affect the abundance of the population.
Is this because lobsters are really kind of insects that live in the water?
Right. They are not that distantly related to insects. They certainly look a lot like certain insects. A scorpion comes to mind. They have a nervous system that's about the equivalent of a housefly or a mosquito.
When we drop them in the boiling water, they really don't feel much?
We don't really know at all. And my assumption is that they probably do feel some kind of pain, which is why I kill them before I put them in the boiling water. I use the Julia Child method.
A little skewer?
You cut the head in half with a kitchen knife is the way to put it bluntly. It seems more gruesome, but if you're going to eat lobster, you have to kill the animal, and that's by far the more humane way to do it than boiling it alive.
Well, there are all sorts of theories as to what happens when you put it in boiling water. If it's alive, then supposedly there's some kind of adrenaline rush which changes the flavor.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of theories on how the lobster nervous system might handle this experience. And it's quite funny. Some people have theories of if you hypnotize the lobster before putting it in the water, then it will not only taste better, but it will suffer less.
Hypnotize?
Yeah, well, they put it on its nose and rub its head. But some scientists at the University of Maine actually decided to test some of these theories. They discovered that the hypnotism method actually seems to prolong the lobster's suffering.
Well, that's what happened when somebody tried to hypnotize me. It prolonged my suffering, that's for sure. Why do you think this sudden fascination with lobsters? We have a couple of books like The Lobster Chronicles, Perfect Storm, yours.
Yeah, I think that the lobster in particular captivates us for a couple of reasons. The lobster man, the fisherman, is sort of like the last cowboy of the East. You know, he's a rugged individualist who seems to represent something uniquely American about the Yankee past. So I think that has something to do with it. But another thing that I think is that the lobster is a very high-class food. We consider it a luxurious food, and it hasn't always had that status.
It used to be
junk food 100 years ago. But now it's this very high-class food. It goes with white tablecloths and, candlelight, unless you've got a clam bake. And at the same time, it is the last animal that we kill ourselves in the kitchen and that arrives on our plate whole. So we have to face the fact of this animal that we're eating. And I think it allows us to commune a little bit with nature in a way that other foods don't.
A lot of people who'd be very squeamish about eating a fish with the head on and the tail on, don't think twice about doing with a lobster. And the reason lobster has become a luxury item is because there are fewer of them?
No, there are actually more lobsters now. The past 15 years, the lobster population has expanded. The catch in Maine has tripled. It is an extraordinary success story. Now, there's the danger that the lobster fishery could become a victim of its own success. Now that expectations have been raised so high, if the catch falls back down to a lower level, people will be having trouble and going out of business and that kind of thing. But the transformation of the lobster over the past 100 years has a lot to do with the wealthy urbanites who came from eastern cities like New York, like Boston, Philadelphia, discovered the pristine beauty of Maine. And the boiled fresh lobster suddenly became a symbol of that luxurious beauty.
Trevor Corson, C-O-R-S-O-N, will be giving a talk tonight at 7 o'clock at the American Museum of Natural History. His book, The Secret Life of Lobsters, How Fishermen and Scientists Are Unraveling the Mysteries of Our Favorite Crustacean, is published by HarperCollins. And just one more thing, now that you've taken this break from writing about politics and Asia and economics and all the other things that people aspire to, are you going to go back to it?
I've got a draft on my desk right now for an article on China, so yes, I have to say it's true.
Meanwhile, thank you so much for coming by and talking about this. And the Chinese make very good lobster, don't they?
They have some excellent lobster recipes.